And good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It is a Thursday, June the 1st, 2017. Can you believe it? We are already into the month of June. Where has the time gone? 12 minutes after the hour here at WWGH Radio, I'm Scott Spears. And we're joined this hour by one of my favorite people, favorite guests, because she keeps us in the know in regard to everything going on in Washington. And there is no shortage of things going on in Washington over the last 6 months. She's a former panelist on the long-running television series, The McLaughlin Group, currently with The Daily Beast. We are always glad to welcome to these microphones Eleanor Clift. Eleanor, how are you?
Good, thank you. Glad to be with you.
Yes, always good to speak with you. You know, Eleanor, living there in the D.C. area, what is the mood like there? Is it different than it has been in the past?
Oh, I think it's a constant adjustment and readjustment ever since the election, because, you know, Washington is really predicated on things unfolding in certain ways. And you can even set aside, you know, policy and ideology. But Trump has just upended so many of the ways that we're accustomed to doing things in Washington. And, you know, maybe that was needed and maybe much of the country is cheering. But I do think that Washington is still adjusting to this new resident, and I think he's still adjusting to Washington. And I think that you know, he's had to rethink how he's operating his White House, and he's coming to an understanding that it's very difficult to get legislation through Capitol Hill, even if you have one party control of all three branches of government. So I think it's a learning process on both sides here in this, fourth month of the Trump administration.
You know, Eleanor, the thing that baffles me is that every so often we hear something about policy, we hear about the budget, we hear about health care, and that dominates the news for about a day, maybe 2 days, and then it's almost like it didn't happen, and we don't hear about it anymore, because the news cycle moves, and we are back to Russia, or we are back to what a comedian does. Are things getting done at all, policy-wise?
No, and you hear, you know, some Republicans say that, you know, the president has to reorder his White House so that they can focus on the issues that matter, which basically are getting a new health care plan done, tax reform, infrastructure. But frankly, I think all the diversions are helping Trump in the sense that none of these legislative initiatives are going anywhere. And there's a lot of rebellion. Forget the Democrats, the rebellion within the Republican Party. They're trying to do all this on their own, and they've got enough divisions between their conservatives / libertarians and their moderate, generally more of the Northeastern Republicans. And it doesn't look like they're getting any closer to figuring out how to get over those divides, and the health care bill looks, at least for the moment, dead in the water in the Senate. There's very little work being done on tax reform. And so when I started out saying that, you know, they've upended the way things are done, you know, in Washington, we are accustomed to, for major pieces of legislation, there are hearings and there's, you know, analyses and back and forth. And they've just done away with all of that and are just trying to surface legislation at the last minute and cobble together enough Republican votes to get it through. Has the makings of a disaster written all over it. A, they're likely not to get it through, and B, if they do get it through, the legislation that they're proposing looks to be quite disastrous in the way that it just would reinforce the economic divide in this country and do nothing really for the people that were the core of President Trump's support.
You know, Eleanor, right after the election, I kept hearing that because of the way the 2018 elections are set up, that there was no way in the world that the Democrats could take back over the House or the Senate. Then, starting 2 weeks ago, I'm hearing that it's quite a possibility. Is it? Is it not? What has changed?
Well, I think the Senate, if you look at their, there are like 25 Democrats who are up for re-election and a much smaller number of Republicans, and a dozen of those Democrats, 10 of them, I think, are in states that that Trump carried. So I think the feeling is that to take back the Senate majority is an uphill climb, but the House is looking more and more achievable. The Democrats would need 24 seats to regain control. And if you look back at the first midterm election for Bill Clinton, Democrats lost 54 seats. The first midterm election for Barack Obama, Democrats lost 63 seats. So there's a history here of that first midterm election being quite a wave in the House. Now, what's different, even in the last, you know, 4 years or 8 years, is the amount of gerrymandering that's been done. And there are a lot more safe Republican districts, safe Democratic districts too, but a lot more Republican districts. And so it's not as easy as it should be if you just look at the numbers. But I think Democrats feel they have a real opportunity with the House. And a lot of eyes are going to be focused on that Georgia special election coming up, I think, in maybe 10 days or so, because that's a suburban Atlanta district with educated people where you would think there's some disillusionment setting in about Trump. It's a Republican district, but not hardcore conservative. The kind of district that the Democrats would have to swing back to themselves if they're going to have any hope of regaining the majority.
What would change? Let's say that the Democrats did gain back the House. How would that change things under a Trump presidency?
Well, first of all, it would make impeachment proceedings possible. Impeachment proceedings have to begin in the House, and the likelihood is that unless Trump does something truly egregious, his party is going to protect him. So if the Democrats come in, I think presumably by 2018 we will know what Mr. Mueller has found out. We will see the results of some of the lawsuits about Trump violating the emoluments clause and violations of his family businesses profiting off the government. So Democrats could bring impeachment articles that they would would take a majority in the House to pass, and presumably that would allow that to get underway, assuming things haven't radically improved from where they are today. Then the Senate, of course, the House impeaches, the Senate convicts, and you would need a two-thirds vote in the Senate. So just as with Bill Clinton, the Democrats stayed loyal to him, and most of the Republicans voted to convict, but he survived. And so there's no certainty that if impeachment proceedings got underway, that they would necessarily lead to a conviction. You know, as I watch this presidency unfold, there are just so many scenarios. It can go in so many different directions. And you know, I hear people suggesting that the president could resign if things get too uncomfortable. He could also fix his presidency and rally his party, and he is unique in being able to shed a lot of Republican orthodoxy, and he is also unique in kind of understanding the mood of the country. So I don't write him off just yet. it's just really difficult to know where this presidency is going until we get some more facts in, particularly on the Russian influence.
Most people, I would think, listening to this program, remember the impeachment of President Bill Clinton, and we all knew what that was about. It was about lying under oath. But this just seems much more big. Is it just because of the proliferation of the internet and cable television, or is this, if proved out, which we don't know that it is this a worse crime?
Well, first of all, there was what we call a feeding frenzy around Bill Clinton, even though the cable news, the internet shows were not nearly, and social media was not as dominant as they are today. It still pretty much took over everything back in those days as well. Well, if it's proven that President Trump and the people around him were made into dupes of the Russians, either witting or unwitting. And that was what former CIA Director John Brennan testified, I think it was last week. He said, he doesn't know really what the motivations are here, but the amount of contact, sent his alarm bells ringing. And the White House seems to keep playing into this. I mean, there was now a Washington Post story that these compounds that the Russians had in the, I think, in Virginia and also on Long Island, that President Trump had booted them from in retaliation for what everybody now acknowledges was their very blatant attempt to interfere in our election. The Trump White House is now apparently ready to open those compounds back up. And they've also apparently walked away from any pressure in Moscow to recover a compound that United States diplomatic personnel were using. So there's no quid pro quo. So you wonder, why would he do this now? The optics, which is a favorite word in Washington, the optics, couldn't be worse. It just reinforces this notion that, whenever there's a decision to be made, he comes down on the side that's friendly to Russia. And he's upended, and I keep using that word, but he's upended decades of Republican foreign policy. The Republicans were the ones who were always, tough on Russia. And the Democrats were the ones who sought detente and wanted friendlier relations. And now, completely turned that around, and the Republicans are now defending the attempt by Jared Kushner, evidently, to set up a kind of a secret hotline that would take place out of the Russian embassy in Washington, which is just, I think, if you put that in a spy novel, your editor would say, oh, that's not how it works. you can't put that in. That's too fanciful. So, there's just so many of these happenstances, coincidences, meetings they forgot to disclose, so that it's finally added up to a whole lot of something, whether there's anything actually, illegal here. I don't know, but I think the special counsel is looking at what I would broadly characterize as financial crimes. And those could well date to before Donald Trump entered the White House. And I think that's the likeliest line of inquiry, I think, that could eventually really create problems for Donald Trump.
The interesting thing is, Eleanor, the big news this morning, the breaking news, as it were, is that former FBI Director Comey is going to testify publicly before the Senate panel next Thursday, a week from today, on June the 8th. Now, not directly involved with Russia, but if Comey testifies publicly on television, it'll be there for everybody to see, that President Trump asked him not to investigate Flynn, isn't that obstruction of justice?
Well, I think Comey has already let it be known that Trump basically said, you know, if you could go light on him, that would be great, or something to that effect. So the broad contours of that conversation are already out there. Now, I think there are probably differing legal opinions. Is that obstruction of justice, or if it wasn't a command, it was an ask, and Comey stayed on, suggesting that he felt that the situation was manageable. So that it may fall in a gray area there. But, you know, in hindsight, if somebody's asking you to do something and that somebody is responsible for your job, and then when you don't give that commitment, you get fired, it looks pretty obvious what was going on. So I think, you know, that's going to be vetted in the hearings, and be interesting to see how much Comey is actually going to be able to say. I know he's cleared whatever he's going to say with Bob Mueller, so he doesn't interfere with the special counsel's investigation. That could mean ducking a lot of questions, or I don't know. Maybe Mueller just wants to get it out there and bring this to a resolution. I mean, I talk to people in the national security community, and they are really concerned. And as you start out saying, this is different from Watergate in many, it's not a paranoid president trying to cover up a third-rate burglary. It really has to do with national security and the kind of the undermining of our democratic institutions. And so, you know, the national security people feel like we don't have the luxury of time, you know, to wait 6 months or 8 months for every I and T to be dotted, that they need to move quickly. And maybe I kind of suspect Mueller is a no-nonsense guy, that he wants to bring this to a rapid conclusion. And giving Comey the go-ahead to testify, I think, you know, makes it much more of a public event and makes it, I think, more likely that we're going to be approaching some sort of resolution sooner rather than later.
And that resolution will be interesting, because on CNN last night, when this was kind of being hinted around that he was going to testify publicly, people were likening it to, I think David Gergen had even said, this is like John Dean during Watergate, that if he says it happened, this could be big time trouble.
I agree with that, and but when you define big-time trouble, I don't know that it's indictable, and there's a conversation going on about, or a debate, whether can you even indict a sitting president, or does that rise to the level of an impeachable event so that Mueller would actually take his findings to the House and put the Republican-controlled House in a position where they would have to choose between what the special counsel is telling them should be done and their loyalty to their president, and it's party loyalty, it's not country loyalty. So I think, you know, that would be a very difficult decision for many, although I'm sure they'll all be looking at the polls. It's interesting to me that Trump was elected with 46% of the vote, and his polling, regardless of what he does or doesn't do, hovers around 40. Sometimes it dips a little below, sometimes it's a little above. His hardcore supporters are still with him. And, you know, they look at his performance in Europe and they say it's about time that he read the Riot Act to the Europeans. And they look at many of these other occurrences, these investigations, as attempts by the entrenched Washington elite and forces in Washington to stage what in their minds looks like a coup to get rid of a president who's duly elected. So it's very important to proceed here carefully, and I think the choice of Bob Mueller was a good one. I mean, if he does in the end say, look, there's a lot of smoke here, but there's no fire, I think, you know, Democrats would abide by that. And if he does feel that crimes have been undertaken, whether criminal or political, I think he has enough stature that in a tweeting contest that Trump might not necessarily prevail, that, you know, maybe his supporters would abide by that as well.
You know, Eleanor, sometimes I go back to the days after the election, and I think, how did we get here? Because the conversations after the election, I remember the day after the election, there was a story kind of buried, not on the front page of the paper, that Trump people had had conversations with Russian ambassadors, and they had admitted to it, and they celebrated when Trump won. Wasn't a big story. And then the conversation was, well, even if they had contact with the Russians, that's not going to cost Donald Trump his job, that's no big deal, and we're never going to have a special prosecutor, and we're not even 6 months in yet. And here we are, and the FBI director is testifying, former FBI director testifying a week from today. What happened here? What went wrong? What is going on inside Donald Trump's office?
Well, I think his abrupt firing of Comey, if he had done that, you know, the first week that he became president, he could have said that it was because of the way he handled the Clinton email thing and that there was no confidence in him. He probably could have gotten away with that. But the circumstances under which he fired Comey then brought up all of these comparisons to Watergate. And you couple that with his sort of autocratic behavior all around, and there is a sense in Washington that there's that real resistance is underway, and you have some prominent Republican voices. Jennifer Rubin, who's Republican op-ed writer with the Washington Post, had a column this week saying, you know, would a Russian spy act any differently than Trump has been acting? And she actually used the phrase useful stooge, which is a term of art that is applied to someone who is used as a propagandist, whether they realize it or not. So Trump has done nothing to reach out to other parts of his own party or to various parts in Washington. And I think that he now understands that his presidency is getting away from him, which is why they're talking about retooling the White House staff and bringing in some sort of strong figure who can run the place. I mean, Trump knows nothing about how government operates. He has a very short attention span, not a whole lot of interest in learning how government operates. And what used to work for him as a CEO, it's not how you get things done in Washington. So it's been less than 6 months, you're right. But it's been a long time coming, and maybe the fallacy is that that we expected him to be any different than he is from the way he ran his campaign. Because this is, and part of his recovery plan is to get out and campaign more. I mean, he's happy just being a candidate and throwing his power around, throwing his weight around, but he doesn't have, you know, the interest or the sustained attention span to think through the consequences of a lot of what he does.
Where is the country in all of this? There was a lot of talk of the recovery of the country, whether people liked it or didn't like how it was being done under President Obama. ever since President Trump has come in, a lot of the talk has been about Russia. Under all that, how are we doing financially? Are good decisions being made? Are people taking care of things? How are we?
Well, I think that, you know, Trump, even though he's not getting major legislation passed, has enabled his cabinet to follow through on a lot of the promises that he made. I mean, this afternoon, the likelihood he's going to pull out of the Paris Accord, which, again, he campaigned on, said he promised he would, and very important to him to keep that 40% of his base together, and the heck with everybody else. You have HHS, you know, cutting back on women's access, not only to abortion, but to birth control, for goodness sakes. You have civil rights positions being eliminated throughout the government so that there's less legal maneuvering and oversight in terms of carrying out civil rights. So you've got almost every aspect of government taking a hit in just the way Donald Trump intended and his base of supporters intended. And so I think they're all pretty happy. Now, I don't think we got the jobs report yet for last month, but, you know, the recovery isn't in place. It's not over the top robust, but it's steady month after month of job gains. That's not Donald Trump's policies. That's Barack Obama's policies that are still operating. But so I don't think you can, you know, look at certain aspects of American life and say, you know, this has gotten better under his watch or appreciably worse under his watch. But the unwinding of a lot of the policies that were put in place under Obama will eventually take their toll.
A lot of people, because he is the president, when we talk about all these things that he's doing, we usually refer to him. But last week, the weekend, the news was dominated by Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, because of possibly setting up this back channel. We hear last night that Attorney General Sessions, there might have been a meeting that in a hotel that he also did not recall. Why are people not being honest? Do you think Trump knew anything about this, or are these people just in business for themselves? Flynn, the same thing.
Well, it's hard to understand how they could just kind of forget these meetings, because Russia was certainly in the news when they were asked about it. I think that's what the special counsel is going to try to understand is why there seem to be so many attempts to shield what they were doing with Russian contacts, and how they could be so oblivious about the consequences of not telling the whole truth on a form when you're asking for security clearances. And it just came out in the last day or so that they've asked for waivers, ethics waivers, for just about every member of the White House staff so that they can continue to reap the profits from whatever businesses they had on the outside, you know, from Jared Kushner down to Kellyanne Conway and her polling firm. In the past, people who went into government, they sold off things, they put things in blind trust, they made certain sacrifices. There's no willingness on the part of this crowd to make the concessions to public service. And instead, they kind of resist every step along the way. And I think they do. They flirt with real criminal wrongdoing.
Hillary Clinton was out again yesterday giving an interview where she heavily criticized Donald Trump on Russia, and also talked about the DNC not being up to shape when she got there, and why she lost the election again, and then alluded to her book that she's going to write again about why she lost the election. What is Hillary Clinton's game here? Why so front and center? Why in the news? Why this book?
Well, I don't think she feels that she has to go into hiding. She did that for a couple of months. You know, she gets invited to these high-profile events with a lot of like-minded people, and then she gets asked questions about the campaign. And I know some of the criticism now is that she's not focusing enough on herself and what she did wrong. I imagine we'll get some of that in the book. But this event in, I think, was it in California or somewhere out west, it seemed to me. And it was a convention, I think, of programmers. It was code. And so she was speaking in their language. And she started out, you know, joking that Trump's misspelling in a tweet, I can't even repeat the odd word he came up with. I think it was supposed to be coverage. And so she kind of made light of that. But then she put it in the bigger context of what she thought happened during the campaign in terms of the Russian interference. And, you know, after that Access Hollywood tape appeared, it was, I believe, 27 minutes later that the WikiLeaks dumps got underway with John Podesta's emails and saying unflattering things about Hillary Clinton. And the press was so fascinated with all the juicy little gossip that the fact that it came from the Russians was completely, you know, overlooked. And Clinton tried to put this in a larger context of it's a playbook that Putin and the Russians have used in other countries with great regularity in Europe and Eastern Europe and in Ukraine. They've tried it here before, and it was quite successful. And by the end of the campaign, people knew that the FBI was conducting an investigation into the ties between the Trump campaign and the FBI, but they did not make that public, whereas they did make public the reopening of Hillary's email scandal. And so I think she's got a lot of data to back up her stance that it was Comey's intervention 11 days before the election that really stalled her momentum and cost her a lot of support, particularly among women. And I think she pointed out in the Philadelphia suburbs where she really hemorrhaged support. So people ask her these questions and she answers. And I think she does feel, I mean, she declared herself part of the resistance the last time she spoke. And I think she does see herself as someone who now can be more direct in saying things about Trump. She actually returned his tweet after he referred to Crooked Hillary in a tweet, I think it was yesterday. So I don't think she's going to get heavily engaged in fighting him. But I think she's not going to be silenced, and I think that's good.
I just have never, ever since I heard she was writing the book, and when she does these interviews, the two that I've seen that were high profile, she'll give a little information, but she'll say it's in the book. I just think for somebody who lost the election, who, you know, I imagine she doesn't agree with Trump. I imagine a lot of people probably don't who are Democrats, but it's an odd subject matter, I would think, for a book, because if you...
Oh, I think it's going to be maybe a chapter. The book is, the way it's been described to me, it's inspirational quotes and people that have gotten her through her life, and then there will be one chapter on she's not devoting a whole book. Oh, God.
Do you think that... why Well, I guess maybe I should put it this way. People are complaining about President Trump, certainly a lot of Democrats who currently hold office. But I don't see a lot of that from President Obama, not even really a lot from former President Clinton. But Hillary, you do see a lot. The tweets, she's out speaking. She did the Wellesley College speech, which was very pointed at Trump. Even when the others criticize him, it's not as pointed. Where do you think that comes from?
Well, she won almost 3 million more votes than he did in the election, and I think she feels that that gives her a platform to speak out on. I think Bill Clinton is wisely staying out of the picture. She was the candidate. If he looks like he's getting in there now, I think he would just draw criticism. And Barack Obama is much more concerned, and rightfully so, about his own brand. And he made a commitment that he would not meddle in what this president was doing unless he crossed some very clear lines. Now, I think Trump has probably come pretty close to those lines, but Obama is not yet ready to speak out. I mean, he did go to Berlin and appeared with Chancellor Merkel, I think it was last week, while Trump was in Europe too, and then he gave one speech in Chicago, but he's giving a paid speech for a lot of money to a Wall Street firm, which has some Democrats grumbling, actually.
Somebody asked me on the program yesterday, I want to ask to you, because I don't know the answer to it, and it's all just kind of happenstance, but if President Trump did get impeached for whatever reason, or he decided to leave office, because Tony Schwartz, the ghostwriter for The Art of the Deal, said he believes he will resign. He believes mm-hmm. that's what will happen. So, either way, if it does happen, not saying it's going to, but if it did, most people feel Pence would probably go too now, because he was the head of the transition team that was helping bring Flynn in. And the more we know, the more convoluted that gets. So if the administration gets sullied and gets wiped out of there, by the law of the Constitution, you would go to Paul Ryan. Would this country settle for that in an election where somebody won by 4 million more votes, and we found out that that person was actually plotted against and had the election stolen, just say, well, okay, too bad, sorry, we got rid of the guy who did the wrong, but you're just out of luck?
The way our Constitution works, I just don't see them holding a do-over in the election. I don't think there's enough of a groundswell to bring Hillary Clinton back. So, I mean, I think, no. And I'm not sure if Donald Trump should resign, or if he's impeached, that necessarily that the vice president would get caught up in that as well. So, if it did come to that, I think Ryan is the next in line. I just don't think it's going to go that far. But from a constitutional perspective, that's not an entirely bad outcome, I don't think.
What I don't understand, Eleanor, is the Democratic Party, we're 6 months out of this election and a lot of stuff is going on. I don't see anybody becoming the national face of this party. You don't see, I mean, I keep hearing stories about the old guard. I see Hillary Clinton out there. I hear the rumors Joe Biden might want to run. Those pop up all the time. You hear Bernie Sanders every time he's asked saying he hasn't decided yet. Are these people just going to hold on to it?
No, I mean, I think Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden, you always leave the door open, because that ensures that there'll be more interest in you, I think. But I think when push comes to shove, I don't see either of them as the candidate in 2020. The thing is, there are a lot of people vying for a space in the Democratic Party. There are at least four women senators in Capitol Hill. You've got a couple of governors. You've got Cory Booker, African-American senator. There's almost too many, and one doesn't necessarily stand out above the other. I think I'll just mention that Al Franken is out there, and he's got a book, which is titled The Greatest Senator Ever, I think. He came out of Saturday Night Live, and he's kind of reclaiming his platform of being a humorist, but he's also a very serious senator. And he's even in the mix as a potential candidate for 2020. You've got Kamala Harris, Franken's Amy Klobuchar. You got Kirsten Gillibrand. So they're all very interesting senators. Not Klobuchar. She's been there for a while, but you know they're all trying to gain their footing in a national and international perspective. So I think there are going to be a lot of candidates, and of course now Democrats are really focused on 2018 to try to see if they can get a sliver of power back. But you're right that there, when it comes to national spokespeople, you know, Tom Perez, who's the new DNC chairman, is a very decent fellow, former labor secretary, but, you know, he's not setting people's hearts aflutter. And I think Democrats are searching for the personalities and the policies, frankly. They need to do more work on developing policies as they go forward and try to take on, you know, not only Trump, but the whole ethos that elected Trump.
In our last 5 minutes, Eleanor, I want to bring it back here to Ohio. What is our Governor John Kasich doing? He was guest hosting The View. He was supposed to debate Bernie Sanders, which turned into a town hall on CNN. He's done being governor next year. He's got the book. He says he's not running. What is Kasich doing?
Well, you probably know better than I. I mean, it does seem that his political career, for the moment, there's no obvious opening, but he's done all the things you're supposed to do if you're getting ready to run. So maybe if Donald Trump is still in the White House in 2020, John Kasich could very well, I mean, he's not afraid to go up against Trump. I mean, he showed that in 2016. So that could be in 2020, Trump could face a primary challenge. John Kasich would be certainly the one to mount that. So aside from that, I don't see a whole lot of potential openings for him. And he did come out of the 2016 election with a lot of friends and people who admired him for keeping his principles stand alive until the very end. So I think, you know, he would have a base of support.
What was interesting to me, Eleanor, is when I look at those people, all those people who ran for Republican president last time around, the two that were supposed, well, Jeb Bush, I'll say, it was supposed to be one of them, but the two, other than Jeb Bush, that were supposed to be the guys were Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz. What has happened to them? Are we ever going to see them again?
Oh, Ted Cruz, it's interesting. Al Franken in his book really takes on Cruz and how detested he is on Capitol Hill. I don't see conservatives lining up behind Cruz. I mean, I think he's lost his base of support. I think Rubio is still an attractive figure. He's taken stands where he is not in total defiance of Trump, but he does speak out where necessary, and he's I think he's preserving his political bona fides for the future. He's a young enough guy that he has time. So I think he's handling himself well. considering the incredible divide within the Republican Party. You can't really alienate the Trump people entirely, and yet you don't want to line up as a big Trump person either. So he's been doing well, I think, straddling that divide.
Eleanor, before we hang up here, there, like I said, there's so much going on. It seems like every night there's a news story. Is there something, a groundswell or just a little bit of news that you've gotten word of that has not hit nationally yet? Maybe won't. But something going, maybe in the rumor mill that's going on right now?
Well, I'm actually working on a story about an investigative unit within the Center for American Progress, which is the liberal think tank, and it's called the Moscow Project, and they're hiring research people who are proficient in Russian, and they're just jumping in there with both feet on all of the investigation and trying to connect the dots of all that's happened. And they have an interesting 7-minute video on YouTube, which goes back to Trump's financial dealings and his dealings with Russian banks and oligarchs, and kind of takes it up to the present time. Trying to give it all of this news that comes out on a daily basis to make it more understandable and put it into some context. And so I think it's fascinating that a think tank would be that they solicit tips, and so they're in there punching away with all the media organizations on this very compelling issue.
It certainly is always interesting. Eleanor Clift from The Daily Beast. Thank you so much, Eleanor. It's
okay.
Always interesting.
Thank you, Scott.
Bye-bye. Eleanor Clift, we might be able to get one call in if anybody wants to discuss anything that went on in that interview, 58 minutes past the hour. 740-383-9944. That's 740-383-9944. Eleanor Clift, always a very delightful guest, always very kind to come on the program and give us the story of what's going on in Washington, D.C., and as you know, that never seems to get old. Remember, you can check out archive programs on the internet, wwgh1071.com, dating back until 2016. We thank our webmaster, Adam Lepp, for that. But we are approaching the last 30 seconds of the program today, the home stretch. Certainly enjoyed being with you today. Hope you enjoyed Eleanor and all of the interesting information we went through earlier on as we took our tours through McDonald's of the world, presidential facts, and certainly current events in the last hour. Remember, the TuneIn app is free. On any mobile device, you can hear us free on any mobile device. Just download the free TuneIn app and always follow us on Facebook by searching WWGH 107.1 FM. For today, this is Scott Spears heading for the dugout. You're listening to WWGH Radio 107.1 FM, Marion, Ohio, the talking place. For legendary comedian Ursula in the Little Maid, Pat Carey.